This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. The title of this tape is The Biggest Mistake a Catholic Can Make. This tape is a live recording of a talk I gave in Wisconsin in early 1995. That is, in late January 1995. I am Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. I was invited to talk to a group of Catholics located at a Catholic chapel in an area outside Milwaukee, and I was essentially allowed to pick my own subject. Therefore, I chose what I feel is a motivational talk. One might consider it also a matter of spiritual development. What I mean by this is that Catholicism consists more than simply a series of declarative statements and a series of exercises. It consists more than a series of obligations and a code of morality. Catholicism should be a growth towards the fulfillment that a person should be by the end of his life. In other words, salvation is certainly qualifying for entrance into heaven, but in a very real sense, it is the fulfillment of one's entire life. With that in mind, it was my determination to focus in on a major mistake that Catholics make, which prevent them from becoming full Catholics, that is, full people. It also, regrettably, will prevent them from getting into heaven. I gave this talk with that goal, with the concept, with the intention that one would be able to better identify a mistake that Catholics make far too frequently, and far too many Catholics make it. So therefore, by identifying it in the same sense that one would point out in a health lecture the ways to avoid catching a disease and how to maintain one's health, I argue that maintaining one's spiritual health has a preventative aspect to it also. In other words, that one should prevent oneself from becoming defective in judgment, defective in behavior, defective in spirituality by identifying and eliminating the biggest mistake a Catholic can make. This particular tape or selection is a two-tape selection. You're listening to tape one. Tape two will include the second part of the question and answer period, and this tape shall include the entire talk and the first part of the question and answer period. I point out what should be obvious is that all live talks carry with them the aura of spontaneity, and by the same token, the risk of technical glitches, problems, the occasional misspeaking of the word, the occasional cough in the background, or the child who drops something or starts to cry. It was my decision that even though I read this speech, that you would benefit more from the live talk, the way it was actually given, than you would from me simply reading the talk again under more controlled circumstances. With that in mind, let's start the talk. I hope that you enjoy it, and certainly I welcome your comments, suggestions, criticisms, etc. And at the end of this particular tape selection, we will advise you where you can obtain further ARM products if you wish. I would simply say this as a final postscript before we get into the talk itself. I intended to deal with a serious subject in this talk. This means that you may benefit by listening to this more than once, or a suggestion I frequently make. If you hear something which doesn't seem to be right to you, do not pass over it. Stop the tape, reason it out, and come to a conclusion. You will not benefit from my talk fully unless you fully accept the rightness of what I say. And I will simply point out at this time that I am quite willing to defend everything I say as being in accord with right reason and proper church teaching. that is to say, with the will of God for man. If you disagree with this, you have the moral obligation to attempt to correct me, or the moral obligation to accept my positions and live your life in accord with them. With that in mind, I hope that you enjoy the talk and that it will be a benefit for you. Let's go live. Sorry. They use two tapes because sometimes the devil works on one of them and screws it up. Okay, introduction. I am Vin Lewis. I am president of an organization, All Roads Ministry, also known as ARM. In order for you to better understand my talk, it is helpful to you to understand what ARM does and what I do. ARM and I, for the two are interchangeable, is an educational, training, and motivational organization which arms today's Catholic so that he can effectively defend, explain, and spread the one true faith primarily by means of the Bible and right reason. ARM, therefore, is a teaching institution which teaches you apologetics and evangelism. I am a teacher of apologetics and evangelism. I am not so active directly as I once was. I now emphasize more the teaching and the motivation of evangelism. I am trying to reproduce myself so that you will duplicate my efforts, my past efforts in debating, writing, teaching, evangelization, etc. A big mistake in such talks as this one is not to tell the audience my intention. I intend to remove an impediment you may have regarding your obligation to defend the faith, which is called apologetics, and spreading the faith, which is called evangelism. So that the amount of confusion would be kept to a minimum, allow me to define these terms, evangelism and apologetics. Evangelism is the presentation of the one true faith with the goal that the hearer will accept it and become a Catholic. It is not living the faith. It is a specific effort which is distinguishable from all others. Apologetics is the effective and valid defense of the faith, or some part of it, from an attack. All and any attacks on the faith are invalid. There is no valid attack on divine perfection. Most people confuse apologetics and evangelism, so I will be precise in my use of these words. They are quite distinct in nature. They are, so to speak, divorced. You'll understand why that means something in a moment. They are frequently related, but they need not be related. So if you have any questions on either apologetics or evangelism, I will be happy to answer them later. But please be clear in your own mind whether you are dealing with apologetics or evangelism. Let me also hope that at least some of you have been warned about it. You are not, as you're having realized it already, going to hear a nice, everybody is rotten, but for us wonderful Catholics type talk. There's too much of that type of stuff. I am not here to impress you or to get you to contribute money, although I would be happy if both happens. I am here so that I can, when I stand in front of the judgment seat, justify this particular time on earth. I will be able to say, yes, Lord, I served you. And of course, this annoyed those people I spoke to, but you told me that this is exactly what would happen. I justified this time period on earth. The world is rotten and corrupt. You are part of that world. So am I. This is not the time to praise our efforts. We're not doing very well. Get your praise in heaven. Now, expect some motivation. Some tough motivation. I am a motivator. And all motivation comes from being uncomfortable. Prepare to be uncomfortable. You are going to receive, or perhaps I should say endure, a tough talk. You may resent me by the end of it. And if at least some of you do not want to walk out, then I will be surprised. And if some of you do not want to lynch me, I will be astounded. But remember, the crowd always wants Barabbas released and Jesus crucified. Keep this in mind. One, what I am saying to you, you need to hear. And two, I can back up and prove everything I say.
Challenge me if you wish to do so, but bear that in mind. I'm not gentle with challengers. This talk is designed to give you some motivation. If you do the right thing for the wrong reason, or you do not do the right thing because you are not motivated enough, then you will wind up in hell. So your primary motivation for listening to me is to avoid eternal torment and encounter eternal bliss. Secondly, as you must defend and spread the faith, it would help you if you understand the basics. And this is about as basic as you can get, this talk. But what I am going to tell you is the biggest mistake you need to avoid. And by understanding why and how to avoid it, you will learn a good deal. And learning is the first step in proper motivation. The biggest mistake a Catholic can make? Divorce. The biggest mistake which anybody can make is to accept the possibility of divorce. Now, when I say this word, divorce, I am certain that most of you automatically think of the legal term, which means the separation of property and rights by a court between two legally married people. And you would be right. Divorce means this. And this type of divorce is a human tragedy, but it is not the subject of my talk. It's a legal matter. Divorce, the big mistake, divorce, is a far more inclusive term. Let me turn to the words of Jesus in Matthew, the Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 19, verse 6. They are rather famous words. Let no man put asunder what God has joined together. This is the type of divorce which I refer to, namely, the action of man which separates what God has joined together. Actually, my term needs further refinement. I am talking about the attempt of man to separate what God has joined together. For we all know, at least I hope we know, that no man can ever separate what God has joined together. And this requires yet another refinement. But sometimes simply refining the most basic terms leads to wisdom and understanding. So let me refine it further. Certainly a man is the joined union of body and soul. And certainly a man can, by an act of killing, separate a man's body and soul. My term of divorce, therefore, must be more specific, because I've said no man can separate what God has joined together. One could argue, of course, that the separation is only for a time, and all men will be reunited body and soul at the last judgment, if not before. So one could say that no man can really permanently, existentially, etc., separate what God has joined together. But we humans, here and now, need to deal with the here and now. I solemnly assure you, you will not need to listen to anything I say at the last judgment. My concern and yours is this time on earth. So the long-term view is not what I am concerned with here and now. Life is nothing more than a sequential series of here and nows. And how we handle our lives in the sequential series determines our eternal destinations. Let me, in order to refine this term, but what is the use of me telling you what the biggest mistake you can ever make is, unless it's very clear what I'm talking about, go back to some real basic stuff. In the war between God and man, which is called sin, man always loses. God always wins. God always will win. God always has won. God will always triumph. Because we are given a free will, we can oppose God's will, but we cannot defeat it any more than we can defeat God. Satan learned that a long time ago. Thus, what God joins together will always stay together unless he, God, chooses to separate those joined things. Man, Satan, nature, it does not matter. None of us can defy God. But that does not stop us from trying any more than it stops Satan and his demons from rebelling. Couldn't they see that they could not win? I don't know, but I know this. The rebellion of Satan was a direct attack designed to separate God from his almighty power to be the ruler of the universe. Satan said, "Let's try things my way for a while." Satan committed himself to a big mistake. And it does not matter that his sin, his rebellion, could not be carried out in fruition. He lost, his rebellion failed. This is not my point. The point is that he committed himself to sin, and this commitment, whether he really believed it was possible or not, was what was wrong. I digress. Before I mentioned what ARM is and what I do, and what I told you was true, but now I'm going to give you the secret agenda of ARM. All that other stuff is just for public consumption. Orm's secret goal, and therefore my secret goal, is to get you Catholics to believe in three realities. One, God. Two, Satan. Three, sin. I would say that maybe, one out of 100 Catholics, and I'm talking about real Catholics, by the way, believe in God. Less than that in Satan, and maybe a few more than that in the existence of sin. And if you doubt what I have pronounced, let me point out to you that I am the expert in this field, and feel completely free to challenge me on it during the question and answer session, but be warned, I will respond in a way you will not like. If you are a Catholic atheist, and unless this audience is very, very different from all the others I have encountered, and I don't think it is, then most, if not all of you, are. Then your proper attitude should be like the man in the Gospel of St. Matthew, chapter 9. This man had a possessed son. The apostles failed to exorcise that demon. Jesus became very politically incorrect. He began to denounce everybody for being perverse and unbelieving. When this man asked him to do something, quote, if you can, unquote, Jesus denounced him too, using the same words, quote, if you can believe, it is possible, everything is possible to a man who believes. And the man replied, as you should reply, I do believe. Help my unbelief. This means he believed, but only to a degree and not enough. Recall that Jesus insulted that entire generation as perverse and unbelieving. And keep in mind that the Gospels were not written for one time and place, they were written for you. For you are a perverse and unbelieving generation. I believe that this digression may have focused your attention, so allow me to return to the main thing. But keep in mind, I'm trying to get you to believe in God. I'm trying to help your unbelief. Back to the divorce issue. The mistake, the big mistake, the biggest mistake, is that one should commit, either by act or belief, himself, to the position that one can or should separate what God has pronounced as joined. Let me give a very specific example. One reason why contraception is evil is that it is the attempt to separate two things which God has joined together, namely marriage act and procreation. These two things are to be intrinsically linked. God says that there is only one way to look at these things. Contraception holds that one part can be separated from the other. Let me give another example in an attempt to illustrate this principle. Abortion. Sometimes we are allowed to kill other human beings. However, innocent children may not have their lives ended in justice except by God's own decision. The right to control the lives of unborn children, and by control I mean end, belongs to God alone. Abortion separates this unqualified control of God from the direct action of God alone. To abort is truly, as the old monster movies put it, man playing God and venturing into areas where man may not tread. I repeat, what God has joined together, let no man put apart, or even accept that it's allowed to think that one can or should put apart. This is the biggest mistake you can make. Let me return to my own area of specialization. One reason why most Catholics never do any evangelization and hardly ever do any apologetics is they have already made this biggest mistake. They have divorced two joined values, even if only in their minds. The Prager problem. Let me introduce this problem with a very specific example. What I have done before is to illustrate the principle with a few examples of evil separation. Contraception, abortion, easy to understand, easy to identify. That was easy to follow and understand. The real difficulty arises when the evil principle is hidden with nice words and with apparently good moral reasoning. To illustrate this, I refer to a man named Dennis Prager. In case you are not aware of him, he is a radio call-in show host who also has a TV show, syndicated. He is based in California, in Los Angeles, but I did listen to him, interestingly enough, as an aside, he's no longer on the air. When I wrote this talk, he was on, and now he's not. I listened to him on a New York City-based radio station. Prager is some kind of rabbinic Jew. This means that he follows, to some degree or another, the perverted evolved system which was fabricated by rabbis after the destruction of the temple. This means, of course, that he is not a Catholic, and therefore he is a very bad man. But he does not appear to be so. If you listen to him, then I guarantee that you will agree with the vast majority of what you hear him say. And you will advocate the vast majority of what you hear him advocate. On a personal note, when I first heard him, I actually could not tell whether it was his voice or mine on the tape someone gave me. He sounds very much like I do, to my great fear. But when you listen to him, you would need to divorce him from these propositions if you are to make a proper judgment. And I, who have already pronounced that divorce is the greatest mistake possible, now tell you that to divorce, you must divorce in order to understand what's going on here. Allow me a bit more on divorce. The divorce is not only a separation, but a joining in an unjustified way. St. Paul clearly outlines this in dealing with marital separation. You may separate, he tells us, but you cannot consider yourself single, unmarried. You aren't. You're still married, only physically separated. The sinful divorce not only attempts to formalize attack upon what God has joined together, it associates things which must not be associated together. The decree of divorce from a court falsely tells a man that he is now, once again, to be associated with other unmarried men. But he is not. Marriage divorces man from the ability and permission to marry. He cannot. He is divorced from singledom. The linking of any two things by some common standard automatically separates these two from all others. That is why, as Jesus tells us, a man will separate himself from others and cling to his wife, and they shall become two in one flesh when they marry. So, you got it straight now? Divorce is about a separation and a linking. It all depends on your point of view. And your point of view had better be formed by God's truth as revealed by his apostles to his church. Every joining is a divorce from something else. Therefore, some divorces are quite justified and necessary. Some are attacks on God. The criterion by which you decide is simply this. Those things which are supposed to be together should be divorced from those things which are supposed to be together should be divorced from other things. Those things which are not supposed to be together should be divorced from each other. Those things which are supposed to be together should not be divorced ever. This may sound complex, but it isn't, and I shall illustrate with Dennis Prager. Back to Prager. Recently, remember, Dennis Prager, religious Jew, conservative, politically. Recently, Dennis Prager stated that religion, and by this he means any religion, can be a problem with regard to good behavior. He stated it this way. Some religious people make the mistake of holding that God judges us primarily by what rituals we perform and not how we treat another. Let me rephrase this as Dennis would. God considers it more important that we treat our fellow man well than we perform religious rituals. Let me give him all the possible benefit of the doubt. Let's suppose that Dennis is talking about feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, burying the dead, instructing the ignorant, comforting the afflicted, etc., etc. I picked the works of mercy intentionally. Are these religious acts, as Dennis holds, more important in the eyes of God than mere religious rituals? Now I ask you, is Dennis right? I want you to seriously consider this question, and I shall stop talking for a moment while you consider this answer. I want you to reason this through to its final conclusion, and I will give you one hint. Dennis is very, very much right, or profoundly, damnably wrong. Which is it? I pause now. Think about it. Hope you came to a conclusion. While trying to make it, I'll give you a few definitions. While trying to make a decision is this, a good general rule is to define the terms involved. Frequently, this will make the choice very clear for you. In both cases, the religious ritual and the behavior towards fellow man, we are dealing with acts, works, actions. So a comparison between the two is quite valid. They are of the same nature, human things. A ritual, that is to say a religious ritual, is an activity in which man does something towards God. An act of mercy, whether corporal or spiritual, is an act of man towards man. Now, which is more important? That which is directed towards God or that which is directed towards man? If this isn't clear to you, then let me use an illustration. Recently, a woman in the South killed her two sons. For some reason, this abortion-loving country of ours was shocked by this act. This is not my point. It's simply a gratuitous remark. Now imagine this woman defending herself in court by making the following statement. Sure, I killed those kids. Two of them. I admit it. But aren't you aware that every day, for the last two decades, I have placed sugar in my backyard for the ants that have lived there? This way I've saved the lives and eased the labor of literally millions of other creatures. Are you really going to hold that these massive and repeated acts of mercy do not balance out the two mere acts of killing? This sounds absurd, doesn't it? It is absurd. How could anyone in his right mind equate the life of any human with the lives of any number of ants? Humans are on a completely different scale of creation. Humans are of a totally different value. Better that all the ants that ever will live die than one human be unjustly killed. And the difference between ants and humans, both being creatures, is far less than the difference between human and God, who is the creator of all. Anything directed towards God is more important than any act directed towards man. Period. End of discussion. I hope you all got it right. Allow me a hypothetical dialogue to further this. But surely, Ben, you may be asking, you're not advocating that some Protestant Bible service is more important than the feeding of the hungry, are you? No, I do not advocate this. But isn't this inconsistent, Dan? Either religious rituals are more important, or they are not. You're coming down on both sides. Please justify yourself. The answer is that in your mind, you have probably divorced meaning from the key word. And the key word is religion. Let me define this word to show that once we divorce meaning from words, we are led into confusion and error.
At this time, please turn the tape over to side two, where the talk will continue, and I will deal with the problem of meaning and words and not divorcing the same. Thank you.
St. Thomas Aquinas commented that the sinful nature of lying, commented on the sinful nature of lying. He considered it wrong because it was a violation of justice and a violation of nature. How? The nature of a thing is determined by its end, its goal, and its purpose. Language is given to man so he may convey information, known as truth, to each other. Thus man may know truth, learn beneficial things, and help each other. Thus, St. Thomas informs us, to lie is to abuse language, in that this does not convey information, but anti-information. This is a sin against nature and unjust, as we are not giving to others what is their due.
This is arm tape, the biggest mistake a Catholic can make, a live talk given by Vin Lewis. Side two, the talk continues.
The answer is that in your mind, you have probably divorced meaning from the key word. And the key word is religion. Let me define this word to show that once we divorce meaning from words, we are led into confusion and error. Religion is the God-ordained, that is to say, God-forced upon man, system of belief, behavior, worship, and philosophy by which man is to regulate his relations with God. Thus, as there is only one God, then there can be only one religion, and it's mine. The other things, the other systems, which the mass media may call religions, are not religion at all, but counterfeit imitations. Counterfeit money is not real money, regardless of how many people are fooled by it, and regardless of how much you can buy with it. Thus, religious rituals include the holy sacrifice of the Mass, which is far more important than any action that takes place on earth. But it is a ritual. And better by far the holy sacrifice of the Mass be offered than we eat, or have clothes, or have homes. This is a God thing compared to a human thing. There is no comparison. There is no way to compare, as the respective natures are completely different. And why did this seem so shocking to some of you? Why does it still seem so shocking to some of you? It's because you have made the big mistake, the biggest mistake. You've divorced two things which God put together, language and meaning. Another digression. St. Thomas Aquinas commented on the sinful nature of lying. He considered it wrong because it was a violation of justice and a violation of nature. How? The nature of a thing is determined by its end, its goal, and its purpose. Language is given to man so he may convey information, known as truth, to each other. Thus, man may know truth, learn beneficial things, and help each other. Thus, St. Thomas informs us, to lie is to abuse language, in that this does not convey information, but anti-information. This is a sin against nature and unjust, as we are not giving to others what is their due. This is an ingenious point of view, and it is directly related to my premise. To call a Protestant Bible service a religious ritual is to abuse language. To call Hinduism as a religion is to insult God. It means to have strange gods before him, a violation of the first commandment. You may object that if we followed my advice, then we would actually need a separate Catholic form of English. And isn't that absurd? No, of course not. And I reply in two parts why it is not. Number one, we Catholics already have a separate language. We call women health care providers by their real name, baby killers. What they call a blob of tissue or an unviable cluster of cells, we call what he is, a baby. What the mass media calls a remarriage, we refer to by its proper term, ongoing adultery. Number two, Jesus tells you that if you are not a light on a lampstand, if you are not noticeable as different, distinct, separated, and even bizarre to the rest of the world, then you are not fulfilling your obligation to Christ. You better be ritualistically different from the rest of the world. Your life better be separated from the world. As St. Paul assures us, the world is a primary source of evil. You better be distinguishable from it. So what's the problem with a real, that is to say, unworldly language? Recall the principle. Every divorce is not only a separation, but a joining. Divorce yourself from the world so that you may be joined with the elect. A matter of faith. Enough of the digression on St. Thomas. Allow me to deal with the central issue. Faith. Have you ever really noticed the words of the Nicene Creed? They are not merely statements of fact. They are statements of identification and divorce. They are personal. They start, I believe. They do not start, the following list of statements is true. They do not start, these are some facts. They start, I believe. They start with a personal declaration of identification. They require you to marry and embrace the facts of eternal life. They require and demand that you never divorce yourself from them, even at the cost of your earthly life. The words require you to make these facts part of you. So what? What's the point of this rhetorical flourish? The point is this. If any of you have tried to evangelize someone, then did you do it in the right way? And which is the right way, you ask? It is like this. Allow me to invite you into the one true church and become a Catholic. You must believe, and to become a Catholic, you must believe exactly what I do. And if you do not, then you will go to hell. Do you sense an objection? Do I sense that a feeling that such an approach makes you the center of things? Or as some have said to me, I could not do this, man. I cannot represent myself as a perfectly believing Catholic. Oh, really? Why not? Can God bring you to a knowledge of truth? Or have you divorced him and removed his power and grace from your life? If knowledge of truth is a good thing, and if God can withhold nothing good from us, then how can you not know what to believe and what to denounce? It can only be that you have performed some divorce. You have divorced God from good, or have divorced God from power, or have divorced God from love of you, or have divorced yourself from the effects of your baptism when you received the supernatural gift of faith, or have divorced yourself from your church, maybe you've divorced yourself from something else which God has joined together. In any case, you better not invite someone to believe as you believe you do not believe correctly. You remember before when I said what the correct religion was, I didn't say the Catholic religion, I said my religion, my church. Let me go back to Prager. Let me return to Prager with another of his diabolically clever examples of how his view divorces good from life, as an example of what you're probably falling for now. Dennis Rowe frequently asked his followers to choose between the following alternatives in the following situation. You are about to undergo a serious operation. You have a choice between two surgeons. Surgeon number one has performed the operation successfully a great number of times. He is an adulterer, a drunk, and a drug-pushing abortionist. He fails to signal his turns when he drives, too. He is, according to Prager, a thoroughly bad man. Surgeon number two is a faithful husband and a wonderful father. He gives lots of time and money to the poor. He does not smoke, nor drink, nor curse. He calls his mother every weekend just to say hello. However, every one of his operations has led to the patient dying. So, naturally, Prager points out that we would all choose surgeon number one. And this concludes Prager and the world. The goodness of the person is separated from his skill, and thus concludes Prager and the world. The good a man does, as in successfully treating a patient, is separated from his own personal goodness. I said this was diabolically clever. Have you caught the massive defect in this spurious reasoning? Have you caught the infernal, satanic lie? I will once again pause while you think about it. And I'll also change the tapes in the tape recorder. I'm sorry. I'm back to Prager and the surgeons. I shall tell you why Prager is diabolically cunning. Neither of these surgeons is a moral man. Both are thoroughly immoral. This should come as no big surprise to those of you who read the Bible, as the Bible and our own experience tells us that all men are sinners. But the point is this. What is the moral, I repeat, the moral obligation of a surgeon? Simple. It is to operate successfully. And as surgeon number one, the drug-pushing abortionist drunk, has demonstrated that this operation can be performed successfully, the only, I repeat, the only reason that surgeon number two does not operate successfully is because of a massive moral defect in him. Can it be that he's not kept abreast with the current developments? Then he is sinfully, damnably slothful. Will he not ask surgeon number one for instruction? Then he is sinfully, damnably proud. Does he use the wrong techniques? Then he is simply damnably imprudent. No matter what reason it fails, it is directly attributable to some vice. Have we become so secularized that we have forgotten the Catholic teachings about a state in life? It means that we are to be, we must be, whatever we are called or choose to be. A careless bus driver is not merely a danger or an annoyance, he is a serious sinner. The sloppy cook is not merely a detriment to his restaurant. He is a sinner betraying God by being a sloppy cook. No matter what we are to do it the best we can. And if I call myself a surgeon and am not the best possible surgeon, then I am a liar and a thief when I take money for my services. What is the cosmic mistake which Prager made in formulating such an evil view which sounded so reasonable? And recall that this is the view of the world, and maybe it was your view before you came in. I hope it's not your view when you leave. It is that he has divorced goodness, and therefore God, from everyday life. Religious values, morality, right, wrong, grace, etc., are, in Prager's view and the world's view, and probably some of your views, only to be considered in certain specific areas. These are prayer, worship, marriage, charity, maybe a few others. But when it comes to the real lives of today's Americans, which means money, status, class, professionalism, and other serious matters, then goodness has no place. Let me go back to religions, imitation and real. Let me relate this cosmic era to the area of religion. How many of you think that Billy Graham or Pat Robinson are men of God? Oh, of course, they do not believe the way we do. But they are moral and faithful in their own ways. They look at the Bible differently than we do. But they cannot. How can they see things differently than I do? Is there more than one God? Does he speak to my soul with one set of words and then use the opposite set to Protestants? The answer is no. There is but one God, and those who do not hear him are not merely deaf, they are evil. What about the Catholic who, in good conscience, dissents on contraception or the real presence or the issue of female priestesses? These people are not actively seeking the truth. They are not learning to come closer to God in a certain way. They are lying blasphemers. They need to be admonished, denounced, shunned, and in a more civilized society, burnt at the stake. They are scandalous divorcees. And in a civilized society, divorcees are also given shame. Goodness starts with truth. And truth becomes known and understood by us in simple declarative sentences. This is why the Protestant, the rabbinic Jew, the Mohammedan, the dissenting Catholic, the Hindu, the New Ager, etc., etc., all have complex, confusing, endless sentences. Beware the long dependent clause. It is usually, although not always, a sign of evil, especially if it never seems to have a point or a conclusion. Let me support this with some quotes from another real Catholic, St. John the Evangelist, writing in his first letter. If we say we have fellowship with him while continuing to walk in darkness, we are liars and do not act in truth. But if we walk in light as he is in light, we have fellowship with one another. The way we can be sure of our knowledge of him is to keep his commandments. The man who claims I have known him without keeping his commandments is a liar. And in such one there is no truth. No lie can have anything in common with truth. This is how you can recognize God's spirit. Every spirit that acknowledges Jesus come in flesh belongs to God. But every spirit that fails to acknowledge him does not belong to God. Such is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard is to come. In fact, it is in the world already. End quote. I hope you notice the themes of divorce and separation in that epistle. I hope you've read. In case this is a bit too subtle for you, St. John has just described all the Protestants, all the rabbinic Jews, all the Hindus, all non-Catholics. These people have divorced goodness from truth and goodness from faith, dogmatic faith, and have divorced goodness from God. Their goodness is not centered and grounded on the real presence of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament. Their spirits do not acknowledge Jesus come in the flesh. So what good is their goodness? It can yield no indulgences, nor can it lead to salvation. It is not good at all. Let me illustrate this fact with a personal experience. I was interviewing a Lutheran minister. Now understand this. This Lutheran says, but he does not believe what he says, but he says it anyway, that nothing he does or does not do can have any relationship to salvation. The Lutheran is going to heaven if he becomes a homosexual, transvestite, abortionist moneylender. So I asked him the simple question, why does he do good? His answer was that he does good because being such as being a minister, because he likes it. He himself wants to do good. So I asked him, since all men are, in Lutheranism's view, completely evil, how following his own desires, which are also totally evil, could be good in any meaningful sense of the word. So he broke my tape recorder. Why? Because he had no answer to this. He had separated God from goodness and goodness from salvation and man from being created by God, and now we could not put together what man had separated, not remain a Lutheran, and he sure didn't want that on record. God cannot be separated from goodness, for goodness is quite literally a supernatural thing, which we humans can only do by and with the grace of God. As I suggested before when I referred to the general rule of using definitions, let me stay with God. I shall not define God, but shall use some partial descriptions. Among these are, Jesus is God. He is physically present at a valid holy sacrifice of the Mass. His mother was immaculately conceived, assumed into heaven, and a perpetual virgin. His earthly vicar can pronounce infallibly. I use descriptions because I will not attempt to properly define God. Anyone who has a different set of descriptions is not only not factually correct, he is a liar. And you will find that every one of the so-called dissenting Catholics, along with every Protestant, has a different set of descriptions. This is because they divorce the nature of Jesus from the descriptions of Jesus. There are not two truths, nor two views of right and wrong, nor two right churches, nor two ways to heaven, any more than there are two gods or two countries named Canada, nor any more than a man can have a new wife simply because he obtains a decree of divorce regarding the old one, the real one. Divorces do not change the moral nature of a relationship. God does not see them. But if you see those who dissent or disagree or ignore or define or remain ignorant of the teachings of Holy Mother Church, if you see them as even possibly good men, then you are accepting the validity and possibility of divorce. And even worse, you are undergoing one yourself. You're making the biggest mistake. And it is the type of divorce that will put you in hell. An extreme opposition. There is a famous line in the famous movie Citizen Kane, and it goes something like this. Charlie was not a bad man. He was just a man who did bad things. Bad things are done by bad men. And this means indifferent teachers, impatient sign painters, as well as abortionists. Does this seem extreme? Does it sound like I'm asking for far too much from us mere humans? Is this all a hypothetical exposition, but far too abstract to be considered a practical exhortation to action? Is it only a rhetorical flourish? If you think this, then you have decreed a blasphemous divorce in your own heart. Do you not recall that Jesus does not suggest, but rather demands perfection? Have you forgotten that what is impossible for man is possible for God? If every failure is a sin, and if every sin can be avoided, then what excuse can you say or can you offer for failure in anything you are supposed to do? Did I say anything? Maybe this is a bit extreme. Let me narrow it down a bit. Anything we do or fail to do as a Catholic. I suppose that two good Catholic handball players could play each other and one lose because of a mistake, which is not a sin. But if someone is called upon to make judgments and bear witness daily as a Catholic, the only reason why that person could fail or not know what to do is because he has divorced God and his love and his power and his grace from his life. Or we might be Catholic on Sunday at Mass, but later we don't know what to say to the Jehovah's Witness at the door, so we shut it and send him away. There is no excuse for such failure. It is a sin, and it is due to sin. And if this seems extreme, allow me to bear witness in a personal matter. I have lost count of the number of encounters I've had with anti-Catholics. It ranges somewhere between 600 and 2,000, I suppose. But I can tell you this. I never fail. I never hesitate. Ever. It's no big deal. How could it be? Jesus promises us not once, not twice, but at least four times that his immediate help will be available under such circumstances. So the reason I never fail, never hesitate, is that I simply do not divorce God from my efforts. It is not I who speak and defend and pronounce these truths. It is God speaking through me. I do not believe in divorce. I am a Catholic. Recall those words of the hymn. In it I sing of Jesus in the Blessed Sacrament as the bridegroom of my soul. Well then, if I do not divorce him, he'll be a good husband. He'll always help me, won't he? That's what the saints did, isn't it? And I'm not a saint. Not yet. I have to die first. But what I can do, you can do. Because you are little more when you do these things than the willing instrument of God will, a pen in his hand. As I once said in a debate on the necessity of church membership for salvation, nothing is difficult for God. It is no more difficult for God to make Saint Teresa a saint than it is for him to make you a saint of equivalent or greater holiness. Simply do not divorce him. But then you won't if you are a real Catholic, as I am. Real Catholics do not believe in divorce. making it personal. There's an old adage in advertising, always tell the customer what's in it for him. It does you no good to describe a great product if the customer does not see a benefit in buying it for himself. So let me ask, what is in this for you? Why did I present this? What are you supposed to do with this? I'm glad you asked me, because I intend to tell you. Your obligation as a Catholic is to defend the faith and to invite non-Catholics to embrace it. If you had hesitated, if you had avoided this obligation because you felt ill-equipped or undereducated or for any other reason, then let me tell you that this excuse no longer applies. If you haven't divorced Jesus by some lack of faith, then he is always there to help you immediately, triumphantly, completely, so that you will never fail. And what holds you back, or perhaps I should ask, what has held you back? Did you think that Jesus would let you fail? Did you really? Then if so, you really doubted his divinity, didn't you? And this makes you a Catholic atheist. Did you fail to read these promises, which are repeated at least 4 times in the Gospels? Then you aren't serious about the words of God. And this makes you a Catholic atheist, doesn't it? For not taking seriously the words of God, for not even knowing them. Recall that I clearly implied that, one, this audience was probably composed of mostly non-believing Catholics. Two, this probably was going to be a talk you did not want to hear. And three, that my secret agenda was to motivate you, and motivate you to come to a belief in God, the real one, not the imitation. I don't know whether I've succeeded or not, but I know I tried. Thank you.
Vin Lewis back here again, administratively, so to speak, rather than live. 2 points. Number one, the tape recorder did not pick up the sounds of the people cheering, yelling, screaming, and carrying me off on their shoulders. Unfortunately, the tape recorder is a special filter which does not pick these up rather well and minimizes significantly the great enthusiasm with which my talk was received. Secondly, the next voice you shall hear is the voice of Father Robert Stempera, the priest who invited me to address this group. I had turned my tape recorder off, and then when I realized he was saying something which I probably wanted recorded as a postscript, I turned it back on. So we'll pick him up without the very first part of his talk. Then we'll end this tape, and the second part of this tape will consist of the questions and answers, questions I received, answers I gave from the audience. So again, the next voice you hear will be that of Father Robert Stempera.
To all your people who have
said the Holy Spirit will let you down the world. Now, the other thing that Peter said was, Lord, you have the word of eternal life. Words are important. The lecture you just heard is very significant of word. And we become very sloppy, loose. We don't want to be bothered with anything. This is American culture. This is American lifestyle. And it's a brainwashing operation, and very many have been taken to the cleaners on this. And we don't feel how much we've lost by the sloppy way in which words are thrown around, bantered, and we need this occasion to see that the words of God have meaning, and that meaning, if you grasp it and live with it, have your faith become strong, you will not only go to heaven, but bring others with you. And if you miss out on that, you probably miss out on all the Jewish people. Words have meaning. So this was a very significant talk, and it's contrary to the general, cultural milieu in which we have to live every day. But we need this, and that's why when our blessed Savior walked on the face of the earth, there were only a few who could hear him, because the lifestyle then was contrary to God. Now, I would like to call this to your attention by statistics. Somebody who specialized in what he called it, the population is distributed on the face of the earth, or he knew some of the history. He said that amongst all the Jewish people who had heard Jesus or saw him perform miracles or heard about him,
They turned away from it.
Only 0.3% joined up, got baptized, and stuck with it. 0.3%
by every word that comes from the mouth.
The rest of them, they heard, they knew something, but they didn't pay attention, they didn't care, they didn't take it seriously, and therefore, the prophecies are very heavy in the Old Testament and the New Testament that the chosen people turned away from Christ.
Give the quote.
Very few kids. Of course, we have Blessed Mother, St. Peter, all the apostles, Judas. This is a lesson to us. Although they had him right there, they turned away from him. Peter says, to whom shall we go, Lord? You have the word of eternal life. You have to believe every word from the mouth of Christ.
Sometimes
the just man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of God. So now we have two questions.
Okay.
This ends the talk. Again, the question and answer period is recorded on a separate tape. I thank you for listening. Hope it's been of benefit to you and has motivated you to behave and function more as a Catholic. You may obtain additional copies of this tape or any other ARM product by contacting us at ARM55 Palen, that's P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hopewell Junction, New York, 12533. I invite your comments, criticisms, suggestions, etc. And this is Vin Lewis. Thank you for listening. God bless.
In any interpretation, an expert on liturgical matters. I'm very, very good on apologetics and evangelism. I'm incomparable in that. Everything else, at best, average. Please explain to me why in some of the Bibles, Catholic Bibles, they don't capitalize God's name with pronouns. Interesting that the lady, I assume it was a lady, the person who wrote this put quotes around the word Catholic, and that's exactly the key point. Why this is done is the same reason why all evil is done. They are anti-God. And this is an attempt to weaken faith, to attack the divinity of Jesus, to try to destroy people, etc. All of these things are done for that reason. I hope this point got across, since I wouldn't do it, he who does it is evil. Better think that way. If you wouldn't do it, and you are in accord with God, then there isn't a matter of opinion here. He who fails to capitalize the name or the pronouns referring to Jesus or God in any form whatsoever, and does that, or prints that, or determines that, is doing it as an act of pure sacrilege. Not a matter of ignorance, not a matter of style, not a matter of custom. There aren't two opinions on religious matters.
This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. This particular tape is a question-answer session which ensued immediately following a talk I gave entitled The Biggest Mistake a Catholic Can Make, namely, divorce. The theme of that talk was, to summarize it, that Catholics frequently will separate, or at least agree to the possibility of separation, or separate in their mind and judgment, those things which cannot be separated. And namely, those are goodness and God, faith and Catholicism, righteousness and morality. The nature of the talk, by its intention, was to be motivational. That is to say, it was designed to induce in Catholics an increased consciousness and willingness to behave as Catholics in this primarily in the areas of apologetics and evangelism. The program had been set up by a Father Robert Stempera of the Milwaukee area in Wisconsin, and that talk was given in January of 1995. The procedure was to be that those who wished to could write questions on a piece of paper. They would be handed up to me. I would read the questions and then make comments. The reason for this was that it was decided that sometimes people are embarrassed, sometimes actually ashamed, to ask a question verbally in full identification of their neighbors, that they would like have answered. And so therefore, in writing out a question, which requires no signature or name, they will ask, or are more likely to ask, what is actually bothering them, what is really in their heart, so to speak. This system broke down after some period of the question and answers, and I hope to be able to let you know which questions were being asked or what the subject was if the microphones did not pick up the questions from the audience. Again, the original intent was that I would read the question and respond in the answer. However, this did fall apart at a certain point, primarily due to the unjustified emotional reactions of several of my critics, none of whom, of course, had any valid points to make, but decided that having no valid point to make, they would increase in emotion what they lacked in righteousness, intelligence, and prudence. With that in mind, I will point out also that, in essence, I don't think any of the questions dealt directly with the subject that I raised. And I would also point out that the group of Catholics to whom I spoke was highly divided. And according to the, shall I say, post-talk feedback that I received from some of the sponsors, it became even more highly divided. They were divided primarily on liturgical grounds, and I seem to have increased that division, which of course is one of the things that Christ does and we are called to do as we imitate Christ. So all I would say is, if in talking to a group of Catholics I split them into two warring groups, I can only say that that is quite good. And of course, if the majority goes against me, that is better, because as Jesus solemnly assures us, a prophet is never accepted in his own land. And as Catholics are required to be prophets, if they are not accepted by Catholics, it is one of the signs that they are, in fact, prophesying in the correct fashion.
So now we have two questions.
I don't know where they are.
Right here.
Of course. Another purely administrative announcement. I photocopied a couple of these copies of the talk I gave, if you want to read it. I also photocopied a couple of them. I recorded the tape before I came, so I got some copies of that also. So some of you who actually liked it enough or disliked it enough to want to hear it again, see me at the table afterwards. Okay. Also, will point out that I asked that a couple of the people here keep me on track on the questions if I got off. So if they interrupt me, they're doing what they're supposed to do. Please don't take it as a sign of impoliteness, because sometimes I misunderstand a question, and therefore I ask for other people to advise me if I misstate something. Okay, question: is the Novus Order a legitimate mass? In some things I consider myself quite expert, in other things I consider myself no more than an informed layperson. In this, I consider myself no more than an informed layperson. I answer this question of yes, I believe so. I also will say I hope it isn't. I hope it isn't, because it's pretty much a daily act of sacrilege that people behave abominably. And I would rather think that Jesus is not present there. But I believe it is, for a whole bunch of reasons, including personal ones. And I believe it's an illicit, sacrilegious, but valid mass. Okay, so I hope that answers that question. And again, I am by no means whatsoever, in any interpretation, an expert on liturgical matters. I'm very, very good on apologetics and evangelism. I'm incomparable in that. And everything else, at best, average. Please explain to me why in some of the Bibles, Catholic Bibles, they don't capitalize God's name with pronouns. Interesting that the lady, I assume it was a lady, the person who wrote this, put quotes around the word Catholic, and that's exactly the key point. Why this is done is the same reason why all evil is done. They are anti-God. And this is an attempt to weaken faith, to attack the divinity of Jesus, to try to destroy people, etc. All of these things are done for that reason. I hope this point got across, since I wouldn't do it, he who does it is evil. You better think that way. If you wouldn't do it, and you are in accord with God, then there isn't a matter of opinion. He who fails to capitalize the name or the pronouns referring to Jesus or God in any form whatsoever and does that, or prints that, or determines that, is doing it as an act of pure sacrilege. Not a matter of ignorance, not a matter of style, not a matter of custom. There aren't two opinions on religious matters. Not when it comes to right and wrong. Which church is John Paul II the church of? Okay. I think this essentially means, do I hold that John Paul II is the current pope? Yes, I do. Again, the reason I hold this is because that he, again, to the world's opinion, and I see no reason to doubt it, was elected a valid pontiff. I don't approve of probably 95% of what he does. I consider him frequently scandalous. It's a true embarrassment. But I hope this is what the question was. He is still head. And the analogy I like to use all the time, which I think explains this very clearly, is if a man marries legitimately, sacramentally, and he comes home one time and finds a note from his wife saying, I've run off with the milkman or something like that, well, the man is still married. That woman is still his wife until one of them dies. But the man would be a complete fool to come home and expect the house to be cleaned and meals on the table, okay? Because his wife's not going to do that. So the point is, John Paul II is, to the best of my knowledge, and once again, those people who hold he isn't, I think have a tough case to make, and I've never seen any convincing evidence. He is a pope who is not fulfilling his office correctly, but he's still the pope. And I do not see that the concept, again, just again, I think there's an implication here, schismatic churches. Again, I'm relying on so-called expert information from other people. A schismatic church can only be formed by the intent of the people who are called schismatics to set up a parallel church. Therefore, the Greek Orthodox are a parallel church. They are schismatic. They attempted to do so. Again, based on what I have heard, I have no reason to doubt it whatsoever. I have not done a lot of research in it. Therefore, the Lefebvreite, Pius X people, etc., are not, I repeat, not schismatic. Okay? For those of you not aware, there was a debate between Michael Davies and E. Michael Jones, the guy who, Michael Davies is a scholar that some people might know, and I don't have great faith in him in a lot of matters. And E. Michael Jones is a fellow who publishes Fidelity magazine, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, a lunatic evil person. But the point is, they debated this issue, and although I did not attend the debate, I've known a number of people who listened to it, and a number of people who attended it. And those people to whom I give perfect credibility, because of the personal holiness of their lives and their commitment to Catholicism, told me that Michael Davies proved without a doubt whatsoever that the Pius X people are not in schism whatsoever. And it was a decree from Rome, the Vatican, which confirmed this. So the point is, I assume that's what this question was, okay? What does it say? Oh, gosh. Oh, in view of the Assisi affair and the other actions of John Paul II, I have read that he believes, like Protestants, that all men would be saved. Would you comment on this? Yeah, I'll comment in a sense of, I think you can't tell what he believes. I mean that very sincerely. See, one of the things is people do send me a lot of literature, my friends, supporters, and I've been told that John Paul II frequently visits, there's a monastery in Paris, which apparently has a particular association with, not Paris, France, and he goes there, and when he's there, apparently he gives these, it's not public, but he gives these totally, completely orthodox lectures, completely and utterly. I think the problem is that he's very much like Bill Clinton. There's a lot Bill Clinton says we can all agree with. There's a lot Bill Clinton says we detest. It depends on what day of the week it is. On Monday, he's pro-life and pro-adoption and patriotic and against tax cuts. And on Tuesday, he's the exact opposite. And on Wednesday, he's back again. The problem is, I don't think there's any way to figure out at all what the personal beliefs of the current pontiff are. None whatsoever. Because, and I always make this clear, if we are getting proper translations of his comments, if the news reports are not distorted when they give exact quotes, then we've got a guy who seems to be on both sides of every single issue. So does he hold that all men will be saved? Probably. And he probably also holds that very few will be saved. He probably holds the church is necessary for salvation, that is formal membership in it, and he probably holds it has no relevance. Depends what day of the week you get. And that's the best question I can answer. I cannot get into the mind of a person who is literally unanalyzable. How do you answer born-again Christians who say, they argue that the Bible says Jesus died for our sins and we will all be saved without doing anything else? Good. Question on apologetics and evangelism. Okay. One of the things I try to do through ARM is to give very, very quick answers that take all the 45 seconds if you memorize them. Okay? Very simple. There are only two types of people in the world, or let's say, to make it clear, there are two categories that a lot of people could fall into. Those who accept the death of Jesus for the cross for their sins, I'm using sort of Protestant terms, and those who don't. Very simple. No problem with that. Now, ask the Protestant this. If he says, Jesus died on the cross, and therefore men are saved, and we're going to heaven regardless of what we do. Got it. Are there those who reject the death of Jesus on the cross? Yes. Of course. Are they going to heaven? If so, then all men go to heaven, both those who accepted Jesus, the death of Jesus on the cross, and those who don't, because there isn't a third category. But Jesus himself says, many are saved, few are damned. So if rejecting Jesus in every way whatsoever doesn't put you into hell, then the words of Jesus are false, because he says, few are saved, many are damned. And if the words of Jesus are false, then we can't accept the Bible at all in any way. So you have a self-contradiction. I hope that answers the question. Was that answering? Okay. Just keep nodding for me. Why did God create man to replace the one-third of the angels that fell? Why didn't he create more angels? This is, if I understand correctly, a private revelation. I don't think it's church teaching, but that doesn't mean by any means it's false. And the position was this, that I heard, was that one-third of the angels fell. Yeah, they rebelled. And that God has created that number of people to finish, sort of take their places, and then that'll be the end of the world when that number of persons, that last person is created. Now, when you always say something like this, especially in a matter of private revelation, why did God create men to replace this? I don't think I could answer for God. I can certainly speak for God when he allows me to speak for God, as he promises me on defending the faith. But as he said to Job and Abraham, you know, where were you when I created the earth? And they said, well, I weren't around. And God says, well, then shut up and I'll run things. So the point is, I would not presume to say. Okay. This may be one of those things which I call sort of a coincidental fact. Let's assume this is correct. It may be something that God did for a reason of his own that we'll never understand, but it's an easy way for people to think of certain things. I don't know. So I really would be very careful to not answer that question. Okay. Oh, I love these questions. Would a primitive, isolated tribesman who have never been exposed to Catholicism or the gospel go to hell because he isn't a Catholic? Yes, of course. Why? Because he isn't a Catholic. Now, the point is, if you take it from a human point of view, it sounds completely unjust, ridiculous, and cruel. But of course, if you take a lot of things from a human point of view instead of divine, a lot of things seem unjust, cruel, ridiculous. I would simply say this. This is my general rule on most everything. Return to the Bible. Return to the scriptures. I'm almost out of tapeness. Let me hold that as a principle and flip this thing. Thank you. Once again, if you take something from a human point of view, very frequently it seems ridiculous. If you take something from a divine point of view, which is what you have to do, it doesn't. Now, what I like to do is to go back to Scripture and look at, do we have an example of an isolated individual in Scripture who otherwise, now of course we're assuming this isolated tribesman is not a guy running around performing abortions and worshiping a tree. If he is, he deserves to go to hell for that. So that, if just to make the hypothetical, let's make this as good as he can be. Okay? So let's make him a guy who's faithful to his wife, good to his children, charitable to his neighbors, tells the truth, keeps his contracts, all that stuff. So, because the bad guy goes to hell anyway, so we don't really care about that. The Hindus all go to hell because they think it's great to burn widows when the husband's dying. You know? And they think it's great to put rice in front of a statue of a monkey and let their children die. People who do that deserve to go to hell. I don't care what they heard anything else. So the law written in their heart tells them they're wrong. But the point is, let us see if we can find an analogy or an example or an illustration of a good man, a completely ignorant native, quote-unquote, in Scripture. Now, do we have a situation of a man who otherwise was just, otherwise was good, otherwise was righteous, but was completely and utterly ignorant of a very important Catholic dogma? Yes, we do. And, as a matter of fact, this man was going to do something objectively wrong out of this ignorance. And it's interesting because hardly anybody ever realizes this. And that man was called St. Joseph. He was completely unaware of the Catholic dogma of the Virgin Birth, that the Blessed Mother conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit and no human cooperation, Jesus, during the Incarnation. So St. Joseph, being a just man, was going to set her aside quietly so she would not be exposed to law, because his own mind said, gee whiz, she must have committed adultery. And God sent an angel to warn him at night. And we have other angels appearing to the wise men to tell him, don't go back this way. And we have other angels appearing to St. Joseph saying, take the child into Egypt, Herod seeks his death. Now, therefore we have a scriptural principle that the messengers of God, angels, will be sent to people to keep them from ignorance. I mentioned to you before about the concept of dreams. I think we've totally failed to understand how important dreams are. If you've known anybody who's ever suffered and I say suffer, the demonic dream, they won't talk about it. It's a great blessing. You get an experience in hell. If you know anybody who's ever suffered being taken to heaven or given the presence of God, as some mystical saints have, or been exposed to purgatory, sometimes they'll talk about it, sometimes they won't. But they almost always recognize one another, because if you even hint at it, they'll say, I know what you're talking about. Now, since God will do it once and has done it numerous times according to Scripture, then the reasoning is as follows. It is therefore not against the principle of God to use a supernatural agent to bring to a man a knowledge that he otherwise does not have. Therefore, it would be presumptuous and blasphemous to argue that God would, number one, send a man to hell for not accepting the faith, at the same time not giving him a supernatural means of finding out about the faith. So, what would he do? A dream? An angel? Or a missionary? Those of us who know a little bit about Padre Pio know that Padre Pio certainly used to bilocate. I often wonder, are there not priests bilocating now to the middle of the Karahari Desert to baptize people who have been brought to acknowledge of God so they will live forever? The general principle is this, of which there is no exception. God puts you in heaven, you put yourself in hell. Never reverse. You can't put yourself in heaven, and God can't put you in hell. So this man will go to hell only if he rejects Catholicism or some other principle written on his heart. Again, child sacrifice, and does not repent for it. But if he wishes to know the truth, as the Bible clearly says, God has a plan by which all men may come to a knowledge of the truth, be saved, and that knowledge and that truth is that Jesus Christ is the sole mediator between God and man. If God has that plan, it is man's obligation to cooperate on it. I have numerous tapes on this, and I won't go further because sometimes the arguments get rather lengthy, on invincible ignorance and that type of stuff, and no salvation outside the church. If you're interested, I would suggest you to call me on the phone when I get back, or get a catalog and look them up, because again, it can get pretty lengthy. You talk of believing exactly or going to hell. I think it means exactly as I do. Explain. I hope that's what it means, because otherwise I can't explain. Again, faith must be more than a series of statements prepared by ink put on a piece of paper. It must be something in you. And I'd love to use this analogy because once, and I didn't use it in a talk, but you know, I have to cut things short, and sometimes I've used it before. But I'll use it now, and it's so clear that once you understand it, it's very simple, and you'll understand exactly why I said what I said and why you must say that. When you go to a bank and you have a $100 bill and you give it to the teller and you say, please, in 20s, if that teller gave you 3 20s, said, have a good day and God bless, you wouldn't walk away. You'd say, I'm afraid you've made a mistake. And if the teller said, well, thank you very much, sir, but, you know, my opinion of what how many 20s are in a $100 bill is different from your opinion, you wouldn't say, yeah, no, we all have different opinions, and walk away. You would insist, you would demand, you would enforce your will on that person to the point of calling the police. That your personal view, your subjective evaluation of what mathematics is enforced by the state. Imagine that. If you went and paid $50,000 for a Mercedes and they gave you a Chevrolet, you wouldn't say, gee, that's all right. Who am I to enforce my will on you? No, you'd call the police. You would demand at the point of a gun that someone enforce your personal view of truth on money. If you went to a college and you met all the criteria and paid $200,000 and they didn't give you a diploma, you'd take them to court. Those things you really would enforce your will. At the point of the gun, you would bring the entire state in. But of course, when it comes to religion, well, gee, who am I to say? You know that 2 plus 2 equals 4? You know the Blessed Mother was immaculately conceived. The two facts are absolutely and as completely true as the fact that this is Wisconsin and the month of January. And the fact that, you know, some of you have feet problems and some of you wear glasses and some of you have false teeth. These are all facts of exactly the same category. And the fact that you insist on the secular truths being enforced at the point of a gun by the state, and the fact that you then ignore the religious truths, is exactly my point of the divorce. What I'm just trying to do is be consistent. I would like the state to enforce my personal views, which, by the way, should happen to be your personal views too, because they were revealed by God through Jesus to the apostles and preserved in the church, in exactly the same way that I would insist he enforce the views of, if I come home and there's a burglar in my house, we don't sit down and discuss property rights, I call the police. And the judge doesn't say, I can't make a decision here. This man says he's a burglar. This man says dispute that the other man's a burglar. But how do we know? After all, simply because the deed's in your name and it's not in his name, simply because he was stealing things and hit you on the head. Oh, how are we supposed to know these things? See, it sounds really stupid, doesn't it? But it's really just as stupid to say you can believe differently than me. That's like saying my teacher marked the kids on the test as 2 plus 2 equals 5 and 2 plus 2 equals 8 and 2 plus 2 equals 13. All right, what a great teacher. Everybody gets 100 all the time. You'd go out of your mind if your kids were taught that way. You really would. You demand that that teacher enforces your personal view of what 2 plus 2 equals, or you want to fire him. Oh, but she can think differently on the Immaculate Conception. That's the point. Your personal view of truth better be exactly the same as my personal view of truth, and better be exactly the same as God's personal view of truth, just the way your personal view of 2 plus 2 equals 4 is. Okay, there we go. Oh, I love questions like this. Mr. Lewis, should say Vin, by the way, do you condone a killing of protesters? Wait a minute. This has got to be wrong. Do I condone a killing protesters at abortion clinics? Now, I can't be right. No, protesters shouldn't be killed. People who work in abortion clinics should be killed. Yes. And I love to ask this question, and I love it. And the point is this. My condemnation of Hill and the donor, whoever these guys were, and Salvi, is one thing. They killed abortion providers in a Protestant way, not a Catholic way. There's a difference. Some of you have heard me on the air, have heard me say this, because I said this on a radio station. And as I say, I hope I've inspired somebody. You do not run up to an abortion clinic, kill the abortionist, and then surrender. You shoot them from about 500 yards away with a sniper scope and run away. Because then they'll never know when you're coming back. So the point is, you don't ever kill and get caught. You kill and flee. That's why this guy Salvi could not have been a Catholic. He got caught. He was really stupid. Now, the point am I saying, are you justified in killing abortionists? Absolutely. Are you justified in killing people who provide other abortion services? Absolutely. What is this, a joke? I mean, are we kidding? These are mass murderers. I mean, let's follow the, not the logic, let's follow the absolute sequence of a word. Yes, a contributor here. You want to make a pledge?
Are you finished with that answer? Or?
Sure, unless you want to comment on it.
Yeah, what if you would kill an abortionist who was going to work to resign to become a leader to educate people as to how wrong the abortion is?
You are utterly correct that if you know that already, you should not kill him. But this is exactly the same as saying, well, listen, I've come home in a house, and here is Charles Manson broken out of prison. He has a knife to my daughter's throat, and he's starting to cut her. Well, I guess I'd better wait and see before he cuts her throat off before I say, maybe I should actually do something about this. Because after all, how do I know? Police officers shoot people all the time, quite justifiably, morally, ethically, and every other way, based on presumptions. Abortionist who kills and continues to kill without making a formal renunciation deserves to die. So does the man. Again, I used to be a police officer, and I'm sure you can identify with the situation. Hostage situation. You know, Saddam Hussein breaks in here. You know, I want this, I want that, and if I don't, I start killing people. Well, let's see if he's bluffing. Kills this guy. Well, let's see if he's bluffing. Kills that guy. Let's see if he's bluffing. Kills that guy. Well, maybe he's bluffing about the next one. You got a police department like that, kill them. Because once a person shows he's killing and shows no renunciation, he's forfeited his right. Remember, this is a God thing. Remember, the Catholic Church was instrumental, not directly but indirectly, in the burning of people for blasphemy. Blasphemy! Because they said various things about the Bible the wrong way. Thank God we had a more civilized society then in which blasphemies were done. These people, notice, this is the thing about abortionists that really gets to me. If they actually said, you know, we're killing people because we find them inconvenient, sort of the way the Nazis did, you could almost understand it. It's the denial of the existence of life which is the blasphemy against God. They deserve to be killed for the blasphemy, if not for the actual killing. Okay, hope that answers your question. Yes?
Didn't today's epistle say, I will repay?
Sure it does. Absolutely. Absolutely. Utterly. Absolutely. If there is...
I'll interject here. The questioner stated, doesn't the gospel reading say, return good for evil and do not attempt to overcome evil with evil? Of course I agreed.
Principles in Scripture in which you can take one verse and you can build something about it. If you remember what it also said was, treat your enemy with kindness and justice, because that way you will be pouring hot, lighted, burning coals on his head. So what is the motivation here? You want to cause your enemy pain? Do it my way. And you are utterly, completely correct that we are required to take other motives first. But the principle is this. Is there a commandment that says do not kill? No, nowhere in the Bible. It says thou shalt not do murder. If you read the Old Testament, it says right after those, because there's 613 mitzvahs, as the Jews call it, in which there are mandated penalties of execution. Now, if the new law has replaced the old law, and it has, and the new covenant has replaced the old covenant, then let's look in the new covenant. What does St. Paul say? What does St. Peter say? They say that the state itself is given the sword, which was a means of execution. This is like saying given the electric chair in order to enforce God's will. Should the state execute ever and kill ever in order to prevent death? Absolutely. I ask you, and I'm asking rhetorically, so don't answer me. If you can say that you could come home and find, say, three of your children or three of your grandchildren dead with bullet holes in their head, the gun still smoking, and the man about to shoot a fourth, and if you could honestly say, I wouldn't call the police, I wouldn't try to stop him, then I would say, at least you're being consistent. You're completely wrong, but you're being consistent. But again, it's a rhetorical question. I'm not going to embarrass you. There's no one here who wouldn't try to kill that guy. Now, if you must understand also that we have to think of our neighbor as ourselves, let us protect and defend our neighbor's children as well as our own. If any one of us would actually let our own child be slaughtered by a madman without trying to stop him, then he is the one I have an argument with, an honest argument. But there's no one here who would say that. Absolutely no one here would say that. Everyone would kill that madman. So what are we now supposed to say? My children count, but yours don't? No. And they aren't madmen. They're blaspheming fools. Okay. I hope I answered the question. But again, later on, feel free to come over and we'll exchange name calling.
Please turn over to side two. Wisconsin Talk, the biggest mistake a Catholic can make, side two. The questions continue.
Okay. If a Catholic in good standing kills several people working at an abortion mill and then has killed himself, will he go to heaven or hell? Well, it depends. Was he in a state of grace at the time? It's that simple. Okay? Now, he kills several people who are working in an abortion mill. Again, assuming it was the situation with the Salvi guy, they really are abortion providers. It wasn't the guy delivering the mail, somebody changing a light bulb, or somebody just walking in for directions. That himself, of course, would not put the guy into hell, depending what his intent was. I think we're dealing with Salvi, I don't mean mentally screwed up, I think we're talking about a spiritually screwed up guy. And I'm not sure if he killed these people because he wanted to prevent abortion or just wanted to get in the newspapers, in which case his motives were completely wrong. You can do what appears to, I said it in the beginning of the talk, you can do what appears to be a good act for a wrong reason. It doesn't help you. Remember, Dennis Prager, the guy I used before, is in favor of 75% of what I like, but he's in favor of it for the wrong reason. If you're against abortion because you want somebody to pay your Social Security, and that's the only reason, you've got the right position for the wrong reason, and it doesn't gain you any indulgences. Oh, gosh. The Wanderer, Bishop Clark, my gosh, what is this? These are just comments. See if you can, maybe you can write that into the form of a question, because I really can't make it out. What is the St. Benedict Center? Oh, my gosh, I'm glad you asked, and I'm sorry. I always assume people know these things. St. Benedict Center was a thing founded by Father Feeney around the time of World War II, briefly. If you don't know Father Feeney, I've got tapes on him. You should know about Father Feeney. You should know Father Feeney for several reasons. One is he is still, although dead, unfortunately, the center of a controversy in this church which destroys almost every... Excuse me. Which is a way to recognize a key way to recognize a real Catholic from a phony one. Father Feeney was a man who suffered for the faith because he held to the proper Catholic understanding of salvation and church membership. Father Feeney founded an organization called the St. Benedict Center. It still exists, although it's split into different parts. And I recommend highly that you at least be aware of it and utilize it as if you ever go up to that New Hampshire area to visit it or buy products from them. Again, they present primarily spiritual products, historical stuff. They're real honest-to-goodness Catholics. They're very fine people. I endorse them completely, and I do that because people ask me. Now, the St. Benedict Center, again, associated with Father Feeney. Father Feeney, a maligned man who you have the obligation to learn about so you may defend his name if it comes up in conversation. I do it all the time. It's an obligation in justice and charity which Catholics have. Can't avoid it. I've got a Father Feeney tape over there if you're interested. And the issue that he was involved in was the St. Benedict Center. Gary Potter, a Catholic author, will be coming out with a book soon on this. You may see it advertised for the Boston Heresy case. I know Gary Potter. I think he's a pretty good writer. He'll probably do a good job. So I would sort of give a mild recommendation to the book. You don't have to run out and buy it, but you might think about it. Yeah.
In the Angelus, I believe it was in the Angelus, they just had an article on Father Feeney.
explain where he was wrong.
I interject. The person stated that the publication, The Angelus, had written an article stating that Father Feeney was, in fact, in error.
Don't misunderstand. Yeah, fine, fine. Okay, I don't know if everybody heard that. This gentleman pointed out that The Angelus, which is a newspaper, is it not?
It's a pious attempt.
Okay. The Angelus is a publication which criticized Father Feeney. Was it?
No, point they said as far as the he didn't recognize...
Right, okay. What this gentleman is saying that The Angelus recently came out with a publication in which the publication said, correct me if I'm wrong, Father Feeney was wrong because Father Feeney did not recognize baptism of desire? Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. Well, no problem. The Angelus is wrong because Father Feeney, like everybody, recognizes baptism of desire as a reality. It is simply not a substitute for sacramental baptism. Once again, without going into it at great length, and I'd have no problem with it, what I would suggest is, after this is over, I'll, you know, go home because it's hot and you're tired, and I'll deal with those people on this issue who want. The point is, the Angelus is utterly wrong. Father Feeney was utterly right. Father Feeney wasn't a perfect man. And, of course, like every human being, he made mistakes. Maybe he was imprudent at the time. But I say again, infallibly, irrefutably, and absolutely, that Father Feeney, based on every writing we have and every statement that is properly attributable to him, was orthodoxly correct on this issue. And the issue of no salvation outside the church was properly expressed by Father Feeney. It was precisely expressed by Father Feeney. And those who write otherwise are always wrong. Now, you may call me on the phone when I get home, and I'll spend the time with you explaining this, but it takes all of about 15 minutes if you're really slow. Yeah. Want the subject?
Let me just take a half a minute on the same topic.
The speaker is now Father Stempera, who invited me to this talk.
Ben has already expressed this, but maybe it didn't hit your ear quite as well as I could make it hit. What Father Feeney is against is that here in our country, for anybody who wants to come and learn about Catholic things and get baptized by Catholic priests, where all this is available, baptism of desire will not wash down. And that's the argument. And the Archbishop and Cardinal Cushing there in Boston was saying, oh, we got to be nice to all these Protestants. We can't tell them that they have to come and get baptized Catholic if they want to go to heaven. Of course, Cardinal Cushing was out of the ballpark. That's the problem. Cardinal Cushing pulled all kinds of strings all the way to Rome, and they put out bad propaganda. It was not legal in Rome. It's not legal over here. He was slandered. Father Feeney had good theology, but it was not what Cardinal Cushing wanted at the time. He said, Cardinal Cushing said, this is not the mood of the church at this time. Well, it should have been the mood because that's what Christ taught. Become Catholic. There's only one faith.
Okay. Again, I have to make what I call a prudent judgment on how long to spend on a question. I don't wish to cut it short. I repeat. I have my, please call me at home. If I'm not satisfactory here, I'll spend whatever time is necessary. Chain the things or wait later, and or even get in touch with me Tuesday. Okay, what happened to the commandments, thou shalt not judge and thou shalt not kill, love thy neighbor, not only if they're Catholic. Okay, so in essence, what I think this is a criticism of me, which seems to be valid. Number one, there is no commandment, thou shalt not kill, or it is thou shalt not murder. Simply read the Bible. I always define the Bible as the book everybody talks about and nobody reads. You can win a lot of bets by pointing out what's in there. The words, thou shalt not kill, are not in the Bible. In the Ten Commandments, which are expressed in two books in the Bible, read them. It's 613 commandments. A son who strikes his father shall be put to death. The only possible way to reconcile that, which supposedly thou shalt not kill, is God is joking one time or another. No, God is joking there. Okay. So it must be, as the Hebrews always point out, thou shalt not murder. Point out, seems like nobody pays attention to it. Noah lands, and God forms another covenant with man. And the covenant has really only one part. Read it. It's in the Bible. It's Genesis. Noah lands. He builds this altar, has this sacrifice, and God says, by the way, Noah, here's what you base everything on from now on for the reinstitution of the human race. He who sheds innocent blood will be executed. Thank you very much. Live. I'll be in touch in a couple of thousand years when I send my son. That's in the Bible, you know. That's the whole basis for the reinstitution of the human race. Nobody pays attention to it. Thou shalt not judge. The line is interesting. It says, judge not, lest ye be judged. That's the way it's usually passed, and I always say the same thing. Are you going to be judged? Sure. Well, then, what are you avoiding? Nothing. If you understand it correctly. The proper understanding of that passage is, thou shalt not condemn lest you be condemned. If you read in 1 Corinthians where St. Paul talks about improperly receiving the Blessed Sacrament, he points out that those who receive it improperly do so unto a judgment unto themselves. The word judgment has two completely separate meanings in Scripture. Number one, making a determination as to evaluation. Number two, sending someone to hell. Only man may send, only God may send someone to hell. Okay? Now, are you saying, however, and if you are, you're perfectly correct, of course, that I'm making judgments on people? Of course, I do all the time. There's no two ways about it. Is this two points about this? Number one, are we not required to admonish the sinner? Yes, required, not optional. How could you ever admonish a sinner unless you can judge a person to be sinning? Are you not required to bear witness in times of evil? Yes. How can you not do it unless you can judge when evil is being done? Well, the point is this. The commands of Jesus, and I think it's in John, around the Gospel of St. John, about chapter 8, command people to judge. And notice the line in St. Luke where this passage comes. It then says, and when you make a judgment, this is how you will do it. Another commandment to judge. To determine if a person is right or wrong is absolutely your obligation. And I would point out this. Which one of you as a parent has never said to your child, well, I'm sorry, Timmy, you took the cat home and tortured it to death, but who am I to judge these things? If you can't judge anyone, there is no such thing as a parent. Zero. Ever. Because a parent must judge a child's acts, must prevent some acts, reward others endlessly. It is your job as a parent to judge. It is your job as a priest to judge. And it is the job of us who stand up and denounce people on occasion to judge. The point is, judgment is necessary. Love thy neighbor only if they're Catholic. No, not necessarily. Of course not. You have to love everybody. And as I always, you know, the example is so simple it's ridiculous. Your neighbor, the guy next door, is drunk out of his mind and getting in his car and is going to drive away. What do you do? Well, you could say, oh, I'm not going to bother him. Or you could go out there and knock him on the head and take his keys away, or you could call the police. He won't like it. The reason I told you you wouldn't like this talk, most of you, is because I did it out of charity. First, love of God, formally, because I want to get to heaven. Secondly, I'd like to see some of you people there, if I get there. And I'd like some of you to be there to be able to testify at the Last Judgment that one of the reasons you're there is I sort of rattled you up. Remember this. Jesus loved everybody and they crucified him. If love doesn't lead to someone hating you at some time or another, you're dealing with the Blessed Mother. Because tell me which one of you, as a parent or as a child, didn't at one point hate your parents for putting restrictions on you out of love. Okay. I hope that answers the question. If not, you had a comment, please.
Yeah. Well, sometimes
go... Another point, which is just an aside. You notice this very interesting point about feeding the hungry and clothing the naked in the gospel. Jesus said, whatever you did to the least of my brothers... There is a distinction that can be made theologically, an argument that could be made that our charity and actions do have to be only to the brothers of Christ, specifically, and the others we can somewhat ignore. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Danny LaGuire was professor of theology at Marquette. Was speaking, and he was promoting this death of dignity, and mercy killing and
okay.
Abortion.
What's the point?
Okay, and so in there he said that the point he made, and the point you made, is that there are 614 laws.
Yeah.
And he gave them as much importance as the Fifth Commandment.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, you know, that they're just as important as thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah.
And we are.
So you're saying I'm sounding like a liberal? No, that's all right.
I'm just confused.
Okay, the point is, the reason you don't accept those 613 laws is because the church tells you not to. Okay? And that's the point. The reason I accept thou shalt not commit adultery, even though it's listed in that same group with, you know, execute this guy and don't wear red and don't eat pork, is because the church tells me otherwise. And that's the ultimate answer to everything, is the church. The ultimate answer is God set up a church, so whenever there was doubt, confusion, that's the ultimate authority you go to. But quite frankly, in a certain sense, you could say Jesus replaced all that with two laws. Love God with everything. Love your neighbor as yourself. Everything follows from that. St. Augustine, a lot of saints said that. Love God, everything follows. Don't worry about it. And will. Yeah.
But you seem to be
Well, I'm sorry, then please, again, a matter of prudence, let me get to the questions here first. Please feel free to talk to me later. What scandalous things does the Pope do? I'll only give two. One, and the person mentioned before, the Assisi situation. I think it was around 87 or so, maybe a lot earlier, I can't remember. But he invited a bunch of Buddhists to the cathedral at Assisi, put a Buddhist statue up on the altar and sat there in contemplation with Buddhist monks. And unless, again, I saw photographs of this, so I mean, this is my own eyes. And a lot of people told me about it, and no one's ever denied it, so I accept it as true. Again, I heard a news report the other day that he was visiting Sri Lanka, and he apparently had said something, which I was sort of pleased to hear that he'd said, insulting to Buddhists, so the Buddhist monks were thinking of boycotting. So he made a statement, "I have the highest regard for the Buddhist religion." Well, the Buddhist religion is Satanism, and maybe with fancy clothes. And anybody who has the highest regard for the Buddhist religion is totally wrong. And the reason it is scandalous is because as the leader of God's religion, you are not allowed to have the highest regard for these things. Again, what he would say privately is one thing, but what he says publicly is scandalous. You do not, as the vicar of Christ, go to visit a Jewish synagogue. I mean, not in a religious activity. This is giving rabbinic Judaism, which is, again, a wisdom-based human horrible system, which has nothing to do with the Mosaic system that God established, some kind of respectability and credibility. It's a terrible thing to do. Why do you disagree with about 95% of the Pope does? Perhaps I exaggerated. The reason is I tend to only hear the negative things, because those are the people things send me because they want me to send back to him. Yeah, I think he's terrible. I don't know. People want reassurance on that. And that's what I'm saying is I hear a constant diminution of Catholic doctrine and Catholic morality. Constant diminution. Now, he says an awful lot of things I agree with, especially when he talks about the real dangers of materialism. But the problem with something like that is, if you could hear the same words out of Billy Graham or Pat Robinson, then that's not what the Pope's supposed to be doing. He's supposed to be separating us from the world. Remember that divorce concept. If you're joined with Protestants on things, you got to look twice. Now, that doesn't mean you kick them off the abortion line when you're picketing outside of a clinic. No, welcome them. God bless them for being on there with us. But the point is, let's make it sure we're there because we're Catholics, and there because they're secular humanists who just think it's a cool thing to do and they want people to praise them. Because they're really motivated, well, they'd be Catholics already. Does the aborted child who isn't Catholic go to hell? My opinion, based on an awful lot of study on this, and I'll make it very brief, is yes, but we must understand hell in a different way. It is not the hell in which you are tormented. It is the hell, quote, of limbo. I've got about 4 hours of tapes on this. I couldn't possibly go into it now. It would take way, way too long. But the point is this. Now, that is assuming, and I have to be very careful about that, that is assuming that a miraculous action does not take place, which, of course, God can always do. God can always do things which we are not aware of. So based on the limited knowledge we have, a child who is not baptized cannot get into heaven, but he cannot go into mortal sin hell because he hasn't committed a sin. So he has to go to somewhere else, and it's called limbo. And the old reference to limbo, as in the Apostles' Creed, was hell. So with quotes around the word hell, yes. Okay. Again, I got a tape on limbo myself. Yeah, go ahead. Well, let me answer the last question, and please raise your hand. Here we go. I think this is the question. Unfortunately, a person wrote a bunch of words, and I think they're supposed to be comments, and this is Father's interpretation. What do you say about bishops who make priestesses for the women church? Well, they can't. I mean, again, you can't make... Well, I mean, a priestess, of course, is, you know, if we're talking about women priests, people say, if you ever have them, no, you can't have them. I mean, that's like, again, every now and then you see these on these stupid Phil Donahue shows. You know, some guy winds up with 9 wives. You know, he marries, he's a pilot, and he marries somebody in Oklahoma, and he marries somebody in Washington, and he marries somebody in Florida, and they're all on the show. He's got 6 different families. Well, the point is, he can't marry more than one woman, even legally. So the second person went through a ceremony. You know, the poor woman, she probably in good faith thought she was getting married. Everybody thought she was getting married. Even if she were married in Catholic Church, the priest thought he was marrying, but the sacrament didn't take place. When the priest says, "I absolve you of your sins," it is based on the fact that you have made a valid confession. If you haven't, those words are meaningless. So the point is, you cannot ordain them. The point is, are there bishops who are in favor of the course? What do I think of them? Well, I thought I made that clear. They're blasphemous, horrible people working for Satan and against God. They have divorced their role as a bishop from their goal, which is to provide good and serve God. They're divorcees. Frequently gay divorcees. Your hand was up? Because I haven't seen any more questions.
Yeah, about the previous question there about aborted babies.
Yeah.
Why would they have the baptism through
the birth? Again, at great length, and I can't give it at great length, is because baptism of desire will not substitute for sacramental baptism.
Yeah,
baptism and desire are terms which have real honest-to-goodness meanings, okay? But the point is, you know, if you look at the theology of this, and there's quite a bit of it, okay, this concept of baptism and desire has only gained, shall I say, prominence and suggestions in the last 100 years. It was talked about in the early part of the church. And it may bring about, in fact, what is called justification. Remember what Jesus said, unless you are born of blood and water, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Spirit and water, you cannot enter the kingdom of God. Now, unless we're going to destroy those words, and don't get me wrong, Jesus isn't always literal. Unless we're going to destroy the traditional meaning of those words, the traditional meanings of the doctors of the church, the traditional meanings of the fathers of the church on this matter, all the way through, we have no choice. Okay. Holy innocence, different system. Holy innocence, like St. Dismas and St. Joseph and Moses and Elijah, were under the old dispensation. And I'm very glad you brought it up, because that's a very key point, and thank you. And I should have made a clarification, and I did not. What we are talking about is after Pentecost. You know, before Pentecost, if you were a good Jew, a good Mosaic Jew, and you didn't know Jesus was the Messiah, and you realized he was God, and you wanted to join the church, you couldn't. They weren't recruiting. They weren't accepting applications. So from the time of the resurrection of Jesus, he taught his apostles for 40 days. Then he ascended and said, go wait for 10 more days for the descent of the Holy Spirit. And then when he did, St. Peter went out. So it was now Roman Catholic Incorporated, founded on Pentecost. Up until then, you couldn't join the church. That's when the church existed. So at that point, the new dispensation took over and the system of salvation was changed. Up until then, the old covenant was in effect. The old covenant was the proper way to go. A conscious man, a good man, seeking God's truth would have become a Mosaic Jew with blood sacrifices and trying to follow the Mosaic law. After Pentecost, a good conscience man would have been led to the Catholic Church and away from the Mosaic law. So the point is, we're talking about a entirely different system. Okay? And that, again, I hope you understand, I don't believe in dodging questions. I'm just trying to make what I consider prudent decisions on whether to dodge things or not. I point out, and I've mentioned this to other people, I spend frequently 4 or 5 hours on the phone a day. So please feel free to call me, and I will explain or advocate this. Or again, please feel free to obtain the tapes. Because I deal with these issues in a whole lot of cases. And sometimes the argument, in order to refute every single objection you're going to raise, to refute it from scripture and logic and reason and church doctrine, will take 45 minutes and an awful lot of references. I will simply say this. I have been debating and dealing with this issue on and off now for about 6 years. I have found that there is quite literally no argument on the other side based on anything but what is called sentimental theology. It is the desire to see things from a human point of view. And I will not talk about your culpability up until this point. A whole lot of people, and myself included, were taught incorrectly. We were taught by heretical people who were in control of the church before Vatican II, who distorted the catechisms, who distorted the theology books and destroyed the theology departments in so-called Catholic universities. And I remember someone saying this and thought, as a total proof of it. But the Catholic Church was so strong and wonderful and vigorous and virtuous in the 50s and the 60s. Why did it collapse completely without a fight after Vatican II? It was because it was rotten from within as far as the people goes. You know, all of those nuns and priests that left their orders, all of those, you know, loonies running around, that you see on the Phil Donahue show now, you look at their ages. They all took their vows before, well, at least up until recently, they all took their vows before Vatican II. They were all apparently loyal Catholics, but their hearts were evil. They were in open rebellion against Rome, and all they needed was the first apparent easing, and the lid blew off, and these people destroyed internally things. And what I'm simply saying is that you cannot, if you wish to do so, you cannot base it, well, listen, Sister Jacinta taught me this in the third grade. Fine. Sister Jacinta, you know, maybe she seemed to be a marvelously pleasant person, but she probably taught you heresy. And that's why I say the same thing over and over and over again. Go back to the scriptures first. Then use right reason. That's all alms based on, scripture and right reason. We don't ignore church teachings. We don't ignore council decrees. But we try to establish things that, and I use this as a cliche all the time, and I'm very serious about it. Very good to use with a Bible-only Protestant. And I put quotes around those words. They will almost always, always, always stay with St. Paul's epistles. And, you know, God forbid I should ever criticize that. But they don't read the Gospels. Now, we're Christians, and therefore our emphasis should be on the words of Christ and understanding the words of St. Paul in the context of Christ. We are not Paulists. We do not understand Paul first and then Jesus in terms of St. Paul. So what I would say is, when in doubt, look for the words of Jesus if it's clear as possible, understand it in that context, and then understand everything in that context. And again, I'm not saying everything Jesus said was literal. Are we out of questions up here? No? We have questions?
Okay. Yeah, we just went out. You got one more.
Okay, sure.
Last question. Do you accept collect calls?
Yes. No, I do accept collect calls. How could I say otherwise? I don't want collect calls, and my contributors will be paying for them. But just let me give you a quick example. Okay, I'm glad you brought it up, and it's cute. Okay, I wrote. That's, by the way, you know, if you read this, you'll hear it. I wrote that if you want to find out what big name Catholic you should trust. And I won't name, because I don't think that'd be necessary. But, you know, these guys that are always publishing books and always on the Mother Angelica show and stuff like that, and always being, you know, they're always reviewing books. Then here's the system to find out if they are trustworthy. Write them a letter through their publisher and say, "Dear Tom, I have someone in my family who's not practicing the faith." Everybody here is someone in the family not practicing the faith. It's not a lie. "I'm worried about it." You should be worried about it. "Would you please call me or write me and get involved? And number two, will you give me a home telephone number? And number three, will you accept a collect telephone call?" Now, if you get any kind of a response, I'll fall on the ground. Then what you do is you get a phony letterhead. You and your wife or your husband or your kids form Concerned Orthodox Catholics of Wisconsin. Make it a phony letterhead. Send the same letter to the publisher and say, "Dear publisher, we're thinking of setting up a speakers bureau, and we'd like to know what Tom charges for a talk. We can only give $2,000. Is that within his range?" And see if you get the return telephone call. And then tell me who you judge. Now, you may or may not know, and I'll tell you intentionally, because let's also make this clear, you better be in touch with me. You better. And you better be doing things for me. I need volunteers, and you need to volunteer. When I was asked how much I charge for this, I said, nothing. Let people make contributions. I don't have a fee. I preach the gospel free. And I will travel anywhere if three people will invite me. And if necessary, I'll pay my own way. Call my bluff. And if you've got a son or a daughter or an uncle or an aunt who's left the faith, give them my telephone number. I will extend the time and effort forever until they hang up on me. And if you doubt me, call the people in my catalog who will testify how many hours I've spent on their children at my time, at my expense. Sometimes they pay for the phone calls. Because I cared about them, and what I cared about much more was my own soul. And what I say is, then tell me, if you trust someone like a James Hitchcock who would come here and talk to you for nothing, or a Malachi Martin who would come here and talk to you for nothing, and then ask me to come back here and talk to you for nothing, and see what I say. I'll be back. And I don't like travel. And as I told some of the people I spoke to last night, set up a debate, I'll come back, I don't want to, but if you want to see me destroy a Protestant or a liberal Catholic, I'll do it, because I have, as St. Paul says, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. And those of you who came over to the table can testify to this. I want $5 a tape and $10 a book, and I said, but if you give me a sob story and tell me you're poor, I'll give you anything for free. They know that, it's a fact. Ask me, test me. Then write TAN publication and tell them you're short of money and you want the stuff for free. And then tell me who's serving God and who's serving money. And am I making a claim for me? You're damn right I am. Because I tell you again, as I said in the beginning of the conversation, and I think it's a good summation remark, you better be doing what I'm doing. You don't have an option. You better not only be doing what I'm doing, you better be doing it my way, because it's the right way. Because you know what? I never fail. And if any of you have ever failed, then you better learn from me, you better imitate me, and you better help me. As I said at the conclusion of another speech, and I'll say it now, you people better be my servants or my students, or don't expect to make it to heaven. And if you think I'm wrong, then you better be on the phone with me the minute I get back to New York telling where I'm wrong. So I better be hearing from every darn one of you. Because if you think I'm wrong, you think I'm some arrogant, puffed up, pompous person, then put me to a test and straighten me out lest I wind up in hell. Because you better be thinking of me as Jesus, because if you don't think of me as one of the least brothers of Jesus, because I certainly am, then you will be judged for letting me go to hell without trying to stop me. Stop calling yourself Catholics if I don't hear from you again. Now, I sit here terrified.
because the last thing I want to do is hear from 100 people calling me all the time. And I thank God that most of you won't. But I also will testify, absolutely, because I can't get off the phone as it is, and I get calls, and I'm on the phone till 2 o'clock in the morning trying to figure out some way to turn my back on these guys who are asking the same 15 questions forever. And what do I say? He's Christ. I can't turn my back on Christ. So I make these massive, unqualified offers without any qualification, with the sure and certain conviction that none of you care, not none, but most of you don't care enough about your faith to do it. So in a very real sense, I once again am back to the tough part of my talk. I'm once again back to the summation. You've got to deal with me. Let's make it as clear as possible. If you think what I'm doing is right, I need your help. Doesn't mean your money. I'll take your money, but I don't need your money. I need your help. I need your hands. I need your computers. I need your word processors. I need your photocopy machines and your dual cassette tape recorders. That's what I need. And if I'm wrong, I need you calling me up on the phone saying, Vin, you're wrong. Vin, you had enough Christian integrity and manly fortitude to stand up and tell me where you thought I was wrong. Well, I'm doing the same to you. Because you know what, Vin? I have to love you enough, even though I hate you, to prevent you from going to hell. I have to admonish a sinner, Vin, because I'm a real Catholic. My religion doesn't offend when it just isn't in functioning when I attend the Mass on Sunday. This is Tuesday evening, and I'm talking to you. You don't have an option with me. That's why I didn't say it in this talk. I'm saying it in the other one, but I'm saying it now, and I should have said it. And I sort of hinted at it, I hope, in the administrative remarks in the beginning. This talk should change your life. If you're the same after this talk than before, I didn't waste my effort, but you wasted your time. From now on, you better be, if not on fire, a whole lot warmer. And you better be out there making religion a personal thing, and you better be making your evangelism and apologetics personal. And once again, don't ever, ever, ever say, I don't know where to go for help.
This ends the tape of the question and answer period. Thank you for listening. God bless.